Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're revisiting the topic of Flint, Michigan, since President Obama went there this week.
So, Tracy, tell us a little bit, what was behind President Obama's visit to Flint, and what did he do while he was there?
Yeah, so the president made his first official visit to Flint, and he was kind of billing it as the what prompted this was a letter from an 8-year-old girl, Mari, who's been called Little Miss Flint, who's a bit of an activist there at the young age of 8. And she wrote to the president saying that, you know, she wanted him to meet with the people of Flint and to help lift their spirits. So the president said, "This is why I'm coming to Flint." And, you know, he met with federal officials from the EPA. He met with Governor Snyder and Flint Mayor Weaver. But he also, you know, he met with families and children there. But he delivered a speech to about 1,000 people at a high school in Flint. And it was what he does best. It was the speech was really geared towards lifting the spirits of the people and to say that Flint's not going to be defeated.
But he didn't just lift their spirits, right? He also actually talked about how we got here, how we got to a place in 2016 where water was contaminated so heavily that children are getting incredibly sick and now are going to have lifelong health consequences. He called it a man-made disaster that was avoidable and preventable. What else did he say in his speech about not just how we got here, but what this represents in terms of philosophy of government?
Yeah. First, I should say, you know, when he opened his speech, he had been welcomed by Governor Snyder, who was booed for about 5 minutes when he was speaking. And then Obama started talking and referenced, you know, thanked Governor Snyder, to which people started booing again. And Obama said, you know, now, you know, we're here to address what's going on. But he didn't let the government off the hook, even though he was trying to be civil.
And of course, Governor Snyder being the individual who appointed the emergency manager who made the decision to switch the source that Flint's water was coming from away from something that had been safe and drinkable and towards the water that became the problem.
Exactly. So he was trying to be somewhat gracious to his host. But as you mentioned, throughout his speech, he talked about it being a man-made disaster. But he also talked about the mindset that allowed for this disaster to occur, that there's this pervasive mistrust of government, that there's always this desire to shrink government, where even if you want the private sector to have a role in rebuilding places like Flint, he said, you're not going to get businesses who want to relocate to places where the roads aren't working, where the water's not clean. And he just kept going back to this idea that it's this mindset that government should be small, that laid the groundwork for this man-made disaster.
And he talked a lot about how government matters for infrastructure. And this is something that you, Tracy, have done a lot of work on. Obviously, it isn't just Flint. Flint is just one example of a broader nationwide problem of massive disinvestment in poor communities and largely poor communities of color.
Exactly. He made it clear that, you know, Flint is the tip of the iceberg. He said that we need to be investing all across the country. You know that there's a lead problem in Cleveland, that there are bridges that have collapsed that have, you know, made national news over the past several years, that this is something that is critical for our communities, and yet this is something that is pushed to the bottom of the agenda, and really that the conservatives are the ones often who are getting in the way of these crucial investments, which is a bit ironic since, you know, they really want strength in our, you know, our communities and our states, but they often are the ones that are blocking the funding that are going towards what local leaders are demanding.
So we have a great episode lined up. We're both bringing together voices who have been really leaders on this issue, as well as voices that we have had on this show before, but whom we really want to bring back into the mix, given that Flint really is top of the minds of many people this week. So Tracy, you did an interview with a state senator.
Yes, I did a interview with Senator Ananick, who is the minority leader legislator in Michigan's state legislature. He also represents parts of Flint and is a Flint resident, and he has a young child himself. So I spoke to him before the president's visit, but he talks about some of the ongoing investigations, the criminal charges that have been placed against some of the government employees connected to the crisis. So it's a really interesting conversation.
And a lot's been happening since we last discussed Flint on the show. So he'll bring everybody up to speed on what's going on there. Then we're also going to be airing an encore presentation of an interview that I did along with guest host Alan Pike, who was sitting in for Tracy, who was out that week, with Kurt Guyette. He is an investigative reporter in-house at the ACLU of Michigan. He actually is the reporter who broke the story of Flint's water crisis and who really got his hands dirty personally to make sure that Flint officials and state officials did something about it.
It's a very timely interview this week. He won the 2016 Hillman Prize for Web Journalism. So I'm excited that people get to hear this once again.
Great. Well, stay tuned.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm joined by Jim Ananick, who is Michigan's Senate Minority Leader representing the 27th District, which includes part of the city of Flint. Thank you so much for joining, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to, get a quick update from you on where things stand in terms of this. We've had a lot of national attention on Flint, and a task force report was released discussing some of the findings, and there have been some ongoing hearings. Can you give us a rundown of the state of play, just the broad?
Yeah. No question about it. And one, I just also want to make sure I note for folks listening, I'm also a resident of Flint, and I have a 9-month-old. So I'm living it just like the other 100,000 people in my community. And I think one of the things that's most troubling is because there's a lot of talk, especially coming out of Lansing and the governor and other his team about all that they're doing for Flint. But I can tell you, for the most part, if you're someone living in Flint, and you were, you know, we became aware of this issue sort of in large part in early September, and it's not much different than it was then on the ground in Flint. Most people are living off bottled water or filters. They have to go out and get the water. There's no regular access to having people deliver it to their homes. You know, the services that we know will help make a major impact on, you know, remedying the problems of lead and the other issues are still slowly kind of trickling in, but any large-scale aid for my community. And I think also importantly, justice for my community. We've started to see a little bit with the Attorney General bringing some charges, but you know, my community needs justice if we're going to heal, and we need resources if we're ever going to fully recover from this.
So you mentioned that you have a 9-month-old, and so I'm sure everything that has been occurring has been very frightening for your family, given the effects that lead has on children in particular, irreversible effects. But Senator, We know that Governor Snyder recently decided to embark on a 30-day challenge in which he's drinking some of the filtered water from Flint. What does that challenge, mean for someone like you who's actually living in Flint and might still be hesitant to drink the water?
Yeah, we have real serious issues in Flint, and we need to have serious solutions. And you know, the governor doing a 30-day challenge, and you know, I mean, he did it for about 5 days, and then now he's in Europe for a trade mission, so he's obviously not doing it over there. So it wasn't very thought out, and it wasn't very compassionate, or it sort of flies in the face of, you know, the idea that, oh, here, I'm just like you guys, I'll come in and get some bottled water from you, and I live the same way you do. I mean, it was unneeded. It wasn't something that I think people were asking for. I think what people in Flint want is they want justice, to make sure the folks that wronged our community are brought to justice, and that the services we know work on issues related to lead, whether that's nutrition or developmental or early education. We need that. We don't need PR stunts by the governor. And I think that's exactly what it was. And I don't think it adds to the quality of life for any person in Flint.
You've mentioned justice a couple times and the fact that charges have been brought against some kind of low-level officials in the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and with the city. This is all part of the Attorney General's probe, which is the largest in the state and pretty unprecedented for an environmental issue. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on with those charges and what you hope to see next from the Attorney General's office?
Sure. I mean, the Attorney General and separately also the U.S. Attorney's Office has got a pretty expansive investigation going on. From my understanding, obviously, I'm not privy to the details of those investigations, but the Attorney General has been interviewing and started a process a few months back and has brought three charges. One for the Flint water treatment facility operator, and then two from the DEQ. And he said to me privately and publicly that this is just the beginning, that there's going to be more individuals. And you mentioned before the task force, and the task force pretty clearly laid on the governor's doorstep the blame for the culture that he created. I mean, if you look at the campaign when he ran for governor in 2010 on his own literature that he was putting out, talked about that it was not that the DEQ, the environmental agency that became the Department of Environmental Quality, was not going to be an enforcement agency. That was not the role. And then you see his first executive order, first day on the job, was to create this agency, and then they crammed down from the top a culture of, not enforcement, sort of helping people maneuver through the system. And then, you see these tragic results, and we're seeing it all across state government now. I mean, we have school children in Detroit, also in Flint, going to schools and buildings that are crumbling, that have mold, and parts of the building are closed off because of water damage. We've seen veterans abused in Grand Rapids. We've seen abuses in the Department of Corrections and a number of different areas there. And now they had an automated system that was fraudulently, incorrectly telling people that are, think about it, folks that are on unemployment, going after them basically and accusing them of fraud, in many cases ruining people's lives. And in most cases, we're now looking back that the system was just completely, it was completely inaccurate. It was a broken system. They seem to have no desire to go back and rectify the people's lives they ruined. And it's a culture that unfortunately is permeated all through state government and is having some pretty tragic results.
And the emergency manager, Darnell Ely, who is kind of in the center of all this, as you said, there's these links between Detroit and in Flint in many ways. He was the emergency manager over both of these cities. And it seems to really pull into question whether or not this is a good system when places are going through economic challenges. What are your broader thoughts on emergency management?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could be the perfect person to ask or the wrong person depending on your position on it. But for me, the voters pretty clearly decided that in 2012 they didn't want the emergency manager law. They thought it was too something they thought was a good thing for Michigan. They voted it out. A few weeks later, the legislature put it back in again. And now we've seen, as you mentioned, Darnell Early was in Flint. He made the decision. He implemented the decision. His predecessor made the decision. Another emergency manager made the decision to switch to Flint River. He implemented that decision. And now in Detroit, we've seen buildings falling apart and mold and all sorts of other damage. And now we're also learning that, and under his watch, he did not send $30 million of payments to the pension system. So I mean, every single decision he's made, every place he goes, chaos follows with him, and this is pretty much the norm for the emergency manager system. And I don't know about you, but in my opinion, whenever you take away someone's democracy, you have bad results. That's the reason, a couple hundred years ago, we decided to fight against that. And I think, democracy, liberty, and freedom have served us well. And when people try to take it away, unfortunately, we have some pretty bad results, and my community is now paying the price for that.
The democratic debate that took place in Flint really centered on the idea of trust. And whether or not Flint residents would be able to trust the city, the state, and even the next president. And both Secretary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders were asked if they think that Governor Snyder should resign. Do you think that is something that's needed to restore trust?
you know, for me, I'm sort of in a position where I'm one of the handful of people in Michigan who serves in the legislature and actually lives in Flint. So my focus has primarily been on finding results, getting solutions, whether it's through nutrition, education, all these other issues, pipe removal, and getting that accomplished. And, you know, I can see why people feel that way. A lot of people in my community feel that the governor should resign or worse, and I completely understand that feeling. It's just not something that I'm particularly focused on. And one of the things I also should note, in particular with Secretary Clinton, she's also helped us with a lot of resources, right? I mean, she's helped bring in, there's a mobile health facility that she helped connect us with, and people from Washington, D.C. She helped us connect us with and help fund a portion of a summer youth training program. So one of the things I really appreciated about her and her leadership is that she didn't just swoop into Flint and talk about a problem and leave. She's actually left us with some tangible results, and I think that's something that shows true leadership. And I'm not going to talk about presidential politics in here, but that's something that I thought, as a citizen of Flint, a lot of people have come in, and you know, and most of them with good intentions. Very few have been able to sustain for a long period of time any energy and effort on Flint, and Secretary Clinton seems to be one that's willing to do that. And that's something I appreciate.
You mentioned that you're more focused on solutions than some of the political issues at play and a lot of the noise. I'd be interested in hearing about some of the solutions that you're focused on right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously the sort of the ones that we know the most about, right, which is, making sure that we have a pretty comprehensive and making sure no kids are falling through the cracks in all the programs I'm going to mention. One, nutrition programs. We need to make sure that we get about 30% of the kids and the families in Flint are eligible for WIC. There's 30% of the families in Flint that are eligible for WIC, women, infant, and children, that are not signed up for it. One, we got to get everyone signed up. We don't even need to expand a lot of these programs. We just need to make sure families are taking advantage of the programs that exist for them currently. I think we need to have a comprehensive early education program so we can address these issues at the core right when it happens. And then I think we need to, the Medicaid waiver that the federal government granted us, we need to accept that as quickly as possible and get people into case management and get the care they need. The waiver would grant a prenatal to 21-year-olds. All of them would be eligible and enrolled in Medicaid and give them that case management to make sure that they get the services they need. I also think we need to work on stabilization of property values and taxable value in the community, because as you can imagine, this water is not just something that's affecting human beings. It's affecting almost everything in the city of Flint. And we need to do what we can to spur economic development, make sure people in our community have jobs, make sure that we stay, as I said before, we can encourage and stabilize home ownership. There's a number of things I think we really need to be focused on, and that's where I spent most of my time. But I don't disparage or necessarily even disagree with people that are making those claims. The governor, by all accounts, has failed the citizens of Flint and the state of Michigan, and you know that's an important thing. And that's something I understand why people would feel that way. I mean, there's talk about recalls, there's talk about resignations, talk about impeachment. All those things are valuable conversations to have. I'm just right now focused on making sure we get resources.
And in the U.S. Senate, there were some efforts trying to get more resources to Flint. One earlier this year was blocked by Utah Senator Lee, who was opposing the funding package. Recently, Senate Democrats have asked Congress to commit $70 billion to help address issues across the country that are communities that are facing similar issues potentially that Flint is facing. What do you feel like federal leaders should be doing and should understand about the work that's going on the ground?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that's one of the things that I think, you know, we as leaders in the state have an important role. And I know I've called U.S. senators' offices and talked to my congressmen and others, and I think the governor should do the same thing. I mean, Senator Lee is a member of the governor's party, and from what I can tell, he's had no communication with him at all about his willingness to block, you know, much-needed aid for our community. Our own Speaker of the House in Michigan has been holding up the supplemental package that would have bring $144 million to people in Flint right now, because for whatever reason he wants to make Flint a political football. Well, the governor should lead on that. And I know I've reached out to him, and I hope the governor does as well, because, you know, people all across this globe, and literally the globe, have helped citizens of Flint. It's our federal government and some of our folks in state government that are failing, and I think that's unfortunate, especially since as we talked about before, the task force, I mean, put right on the governor's lap the complete failing of state government for the citizens of Flint. And as was mentioned, I mean, this is an environmental injustice. This is something that never should have happened. This was man-made, and it's unacceptable. And folks that have ability to make sure that we get resources really have a moral obligation to make sure that they help and make sure that we get them. And the governor can help with that.
And before I let you go, just I want to be sure that you know, we get an opportunity, again, as you, as a resident of Flint, not just a senator that represents the area, but as a resident of Flint, what do you want people who don't live there to understand? You know, the city has been in the news a lot less than it once was. What do you want our listeners to understand about what you guys are going through?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things. One, I think, you know, obviously, I mean, I think people shouldn't blame this on, this needs to be understood, this is a man-made disaster. It was the governor's policies that did this. And then, unfortunately, you have to second-guess things when it comes to your health now, and you need to make sure you trust but verify. That's one thing. And two, you know, the citizens of Flint are strong. We're a strong community, and we're gonna be fine at the end of this, and we're going to be better than fine. We're actually going to be better off, I think, because we're strong people. But I think people all across this country, all across the state of Michigan, need to call their representatives and tell them that they have a moral obligation to help, because this was something that the citizens of Flint, they did nothing wrong. They were wronged by their government, and the government has a responsibility to fix it.
Senator Jim Ananick is the Senate Minority Leader in Michigan's 27th District, representing Flint, and is a Flint resident. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With us to discuss the Flint water crisis is Kurt Guyette, an investigative reporter with the ACLU of Michigan, who was instrumental in bringing the crisis to light. Kurt, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for existing, period.
Well, to help get us started, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been following the Flint water crisis, but take us back to the beginning. How did this all start?
It started in April of 2014, when the city of Flint was under the control of an emergency manager appointed by Governor Rick Snyder. And in Michigan has a very extreme receivership law, which allows the state to take over complete control of cities, school districts, counties that are in financial distress. And Flint was one of those cities. And like the other cities and school districts, it is a majority African-American city, and it has a high poverty rate. It has about 40% of the people of Flint live below the poverty line. And so with this emergency manager under control and the power of elected officials eliminated, that's one of the extreme functions of this emergency manager law. It takes away the authority of duly elected local officials. They only have whatever power the emergency manager chooses to give them. They only get paid if the emergency manager chooses to pay them. So essentially, they are employees of the emergency manager. In order to save money while a new pipeline was being built, this, and we don't know for sure if it's the emergency manager or it's the governor's office, but in any event, the state essentially decides, in order to save a projected $5 million, to switch from the clean, safe Detroit water that Flint had been getting for 50 years to begin using the polluted Flint River. You know, Flint is the home of General Motors. It's just an old industrial town, and like old industrial towns just about everywhere, the river was the dumping ground for the waste. And so just on a purely financially driven decision, began using the Flint River. And as soon as they switched over, people knew immediately that the water was not good. It didn't smell good. It didn't taste good. It didn't look good. You know, they described sometimes it would smell like feces with chlorine overtones to it, you know, and it was just horrible. But all along, the city and state officials kept assuring them that the water was safe. Then it started to have problems with E. coli contamination. To treat the E. coli, they increased the amount of chlorine being used to kill the bacteria. Increasing the chlorine led to elevated levels of a carcinogenic byproduct of chlorine called total trihalomethanes. That went on for months and months and months before they notified residents that they were being exposed to that. And that was in January when that finally got, the public was allowed to know that they were drinking unsafe levels of a carcinogen.
Well, I want to interrupt you quickly there and just ask you, you just said something, you used a very interesting phrase there. You said the public was allowed to know at that point. There were early warnings about this. You were instrumental in actually raising some of these early warnings about the water and its contamination. Why were they ignored, and what do you mean when you say the public hadn't previously been allowed to know?
Well, for specifically for the TTHM problem, the law is that it is not until there are three consecutive quarters that they are out of compliance that their officials are required to notify people of the problem. Nothing saying they can't notify them, but they don't have to be notified. And the state, in the form of an emergency manager, chose not to tell the people what they were being exposed to until the law said they absolutely had to. But people were outraged when that came out. But that's part of the problem with the whole emergency manager law. These emergency managers are like hired guns that come in from someplace else. They don't have any connection to the community. They don't have any responsibility to the community. You know, their only responsibility is to the governor that appoints them. So there's a complete disconnect going on between the people running a community and the community itself. It's not like they have a local elected officials that have any power that they can vote off out of office if they're doing a bad job. It's really the starkest example imaginable of what happens when you take democracy away from people.
Yeah, I was going to say, because anybody who's employed as a public health official of any kind is going to see test results like that and think, oh God, we have to tell people to stop drinking this water. Not, well, how long do I have to try to cover
to
up,
cover
to,
it
to,
up.
To fix this so that we don't have to tell people? It's such a, it speaks to the way that the law in Michigan for financially dire situations at the municipal level has flipped around the responsibility to the public that's supposed to be imbued into public service.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, what they do is they take a democracy and replace it with an austerity-driven autocracy. And we see what happens. In the case of Flint, tragically, it meant that a town's water supply was contaminated and people, especially children, were subjected to lead poisoning. You know, it's the most egregious, which is why I started covering it, because I was hired here at the ACLU of Michigan to investigate issues around this emergency manager law. And when I saw, I was at a meeting up in Flint almost a year ago, and that's when the TTH problem was being exposed. And people were saying at this meeting, why didn't you tell us? And the emergency manager said, well, as soon as we found out about it, we started working on it. And they go, but yeah, that's not telling us.
Right.
And he goes, as soon as we found out about it, we began working on it. Yeah, but that's not telling us. And he looks at him and he says, well, I'm telling you now. And it was just so callous and showed such disregard for these people that were being exposed to a carcinogen. You know, it was not like it was some piddly thing that they were upset about. You know, it's like, man, this is a story that got to be told. And so myself and this really wonderful young filmmaker, Kate Levy, went up to Flint, and we started making a short documentary about what was going on. And this was before the lead issue really became known. Although it started right around the time that we started going up there, the EPA started sending emails to the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, which oversees the water testing in Flint. We just saw these lead results from this one family. They're really high. What's going on? What kind of corrosion control are you using? And the DEQ writes back, oh, don't worry, it's under control. We have a corrosion control program in place. But the truth is that they weren't applying corrosion control, which is another sort of crazy thing about all this and really inexplicable, because the Flint River is about five times more corrosive than the Detroit water, which comes from Lake Huron. And so Detroit puts in phosphates as a corrosion control. So Flint, with the MDEQ making the decisions, at the time when the corrosion control is more needed than ever because the water is so much more corrosive, stops using corrosion control. And so as soon as they start using the river water, which has a very high salt content, it starts tearing up the pipes because it's more corrosive and there's no corrosion control. And so that's really when the lead contamination started. But it didn't really start to show itself for a little while, because the film, that the protective coating, lasted for a little bit before it started getting chewed up.
And you mentioned that there was one particular household that had been tested, and that was part of what led this one individual at the at Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality, Miguel Toral, to realize that there was a problem. And he was sort of the Cassandra, right, who said, wait, you know, guys, there's something here, and nobody listened to him. But then you worked with him to show that it wasn't just that one household. Tell us a little bit about your role in that.
So there's the Leanne Walters is a mom, and she demanded in February that the city test her water for lead, and it came back at 107 parts per billion. The federal action level is 15 parts per billion, and you know, there's no safe level of lead whatsoever. But the 107 parts per billion is really high.
That's seven times, right, what you're saying is what's supposed to be the trigger point.
Right. Then she had tested a second time, and it came back at like 397. Sent those results to the EPA, and it got into the hands, luckily, of Miguel Del Toro, who was a water expert at Region 5 of the EPA in Chicago, and he took a personal interest. He went to Flint because Flint city officials were saying, oh, you know, the problem is lead plumbing inside the Walters home. Well, like, they bought a vacant house, the Walters family, and like a lot of vacant houses in Flint and Detroit, what happens is the scrappers come in and they steal every thing that's of value, including plumbing, if it's metal. And so all the plumbing had been stripped out, and it was replaced with PVC. So there was no lead inside the house. It was all coming from outside the house. Del Toro hooked the Walters family up with Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech. And you guys in D.C. know Mark Edwards well. He's the guy who heroically exposed the lead in Washington, D.C.'s water in the early 2000s. And so he conducted, he worked with Walters. He sent her 30 sample bottles, and walked her through conducting a very thorough, extensive test of basically the system going from the, as it comes out the tap, what it's like in the internal plumbing, what it's like in the service line, which is the line that goes from the water main to the house, and then the water main itself. And out of those 30 samples, one of them came back with lead levels of 13,200 parts per billion, which is 2.5 times what it takes to be classified as hazardous waste. So this is happening in, you know, April, May. In June, Del Toro writes this internal memo for the EPA, but he's a longtime EPA employee. He knows how the bureaucracy works, and he's afraid that this memo is going to get buried. And the memo says essentially, okay, we got hazardous waste levels of water going into this one house that, you know, we don't know if that's an anomaly or not, but the science behind all this says you're using corrosive water, you're not using corrosion control, there's a lot of lead service lines throughout Flint. This is not an isolated problem. This has got to be a real issue throughout the city. And so, and he saw this as a public health emergency. And really, Mr. Del Toro is the unsung hero in all of this. He gives that memo to Leanne. And because Kate and I had been up there taking seriously the concerns being expressed by residents, and our video, Hard to Swallow, had just been released, and Leanne believed that we really cared about what was going on there, and that beyond that, that we would be unafraid to tell the truth about what was going on there, she gave us the memo. We published it, and that was really the spark that ignited the whole chain reaction of events that brought us to where we are now. But the next thing that happened was that we published the memo. I write a story about it. I interview Mr. Del Toro. I interview Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality completely blew me off, wouldn't answer my questions. But fortunately, Michigan Radio, which is the public radio here, one of the public radio outlets here in Michigan, recognized the potential importance of this memo, picked it up, and ran with it. They did get the MDEQ to respond. The response from this guy, Brad Werfel, who has since rightfully resigned in disgrace because of his handling of all this, goes on the radio and says, look, when it comes to lead in the water, people of Flint can just relax. There's no problem whatsoever. You know, nothing to see here, folks. Keep moving, right? And so then at that point is, man, how do we get to the truth? And the solution was that a group, a very varied group of really, really great people in Flint called the Coalition for Clean Water, which represented the Concerned Pastors for Social Action and the Democracy Defense League, which had formed to fight against this emergency manager law, and the a group called What Are You Fighting For? They and the ACLU of Michigan and Mark Edwards and his team at Virginia Tech, we came up with a plan. We're going to do our own water test. Mark got an emergency grant from the National Science Foundation, and I learned subsequently with tens and tens of thousands of dollars of his own money. You know, Mark is unbelievably incredible guy. You know, the altruism that he's shown throughout this is unequaled. So in any event, he gets the money to send 300 sample kits to Flint. And this is mid-August. You know, I start going up there. I'm working with the coalition. We hold you know, public meetings to have people come in, tell them how to take the samples, get them distributed. We then at a certain point, we see where they've been distributed, and because we're keeping very accurate records, we have, you know, everybody that's gotten a sample, what zip codes they're in, we go through, we map it all out, we see what parts of the city are not being hit, because we don't want them to have any legitimate reason to criticize our study. We want our study to be as thoroughly and scientifically valid as possible.
So you were actually taking these water testing kits into Flint homes yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. We, you know, because we saw which zip codes were light, and me and Leanne Walters and her husband, you know, or just go out and start knocking on doors, say, hey, we're doing this. We can get your water tested for free. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. You know, we want to make sure that this neighborhood is represented. And so, yeah, we're going around knocking on doors, making sure that there's as equal distribution as possible throughout the city.
And what were your findings?
You know, first let me say that in a little over 2 weeks, this group, there was essentially seven people that were, you know, from the coalition and myself on our end working on this. In less than 3 weeks, we distributed 300 kits. We got 277 collected. When Mark applied for his National Science Foundation grant, said, we're going to send 300 kits. We're going to budget to get 75 back, because that's kind of like the typical rate of return.
Oh, wow.
We completely blew them away when we got 277, because, you know, people like Leanne Walters and Melissa Mays and, you know, the Pastors Association and others were so committed to this and so determined to do as good a job as we could possibly do, are out there working like crazy. We got four times as many samples as the city collected it in the prior 6 months to this. As soon as this, and the samples, they don't come all back in at the same time. We start handing them out. Some people, you get them back real quickly. So we start sending them back 12 at a time to Virginia Tech. As soon as Virginia Tech starts analyzing it, they're going, oh my God, we can't, you know, this is a real problem. And so instead of doing like a normal scientific study, right, until you get all your results and then you publish your results, they start calling people with five parts per billion or above. They call and say, stop drinking your water. They create this website, flintwaterstudy.org. They start, Mark and his team of these students, you know, they're just so beautiful. They're like working around the clock to get these samples analyzed, to get the information posted on the web. Mark starts explaining the science going on, because they had also, he loaded up a minivan full of students, and they drove all the way from Virginia up to Flint for a couple days to do some like on the ground testing for other things, looking to see how much chlorine where it was in the water. And Mark was finding no chlorine. It was just like blew his mind. How could they not have any chlorine in the water? And so they're looking for other stuff. They go back to Virginia Tech. They're working like crazy around the clock. We're working like crazy, you know, feeling, you know, just intense pressure to do it and do it right and do it quickly. All this is going on between mid-August and September. And it's scary how much lead they're finding. Mark starts publishing the results. I write a story saying the early results are frightening. At the same time, I am doing a parallel investigation, looking into what the city and state were doing in terms of their water testing. Because, okay, I know at that point that Virginia Tech's results are going to come in much higher than the city and state's results, which they continued to say was safe. And so we wanted to be able to explain why the discrepancy. And what I was able to find out through filing Freedom of Information Act requests and also, you know, some old-fashioned shoe leather reporting, going out and knocking on doors to answer some questions. The answer is the discrepancy is because the city and state cheat on their tests. In order to make it appear that they're in compliance, they're cheating, and there's no doubt about it. And so on September 15th, we hold a press conference. Mark comes there with a grad student and explains what they found, the science behind it. We hold a town hall meeting, and then I basically talk about the results of my investigation. And at that point, September 15th, keep in mind, as the ACLU of Michigan saying, there needs to be a complete and thorough outside investigation of what went on here. But the state continued to deny there was a problem. They started, you know, scurriously attacking the ethics and credibility of Mark, you know, who's a hero. You know, you guys know how he's felt about there in D.C., and the people in Flint feel the same way about him now. You know, the same guy, Werfel, from the MDEQ says, you know, this guy pulls a rabbit out of a hat wherever he goes. You know, as if he's skewing the results, man. Mark's one of the most ethical people I've ever met. It still burns me up thinking about the attack on him. And they're doing it because they're, here's the deal, and it goes to another flaw with the emergency manager law. There's no checks and balances. You have the governor's appointed emergency manager in charge when this disastrous decision to switch to the river is made, and then you have the MDEQ, which is headed by an appointee of the governor,
right,
not trying to protect people, but trying to cover up the horrible mistake that's been made by their boss, essentially.
Right.
So everybody's covering for the boss, which is Snyder here, Governor Rick Snyder. And so that's what we're up against. That's what we're fighting against in order to try to get the truth really out.
Yeah, Kurt, part of what strikes me about hearing you recount that story is how many people, how many private citizens at their own expense in money and time and energy had to, how much time and work you had to put in on your own just to demonstrate the fundamental problem with something as rudimentary as public water service. That it took months and months and months of work from this really complex and broad coalition of groups and people that you just described for us to drag this into the light, when because the state officials who were who should have been doing that on behalf of the people of Flint were doing the opposite. And
yes,
Now that we find ourselves in almost February of 2016, with this being one of the premier national news stories going back to basically the beginning of this year, and it seems to only be getting louder in the national media, finally, two questions. One, what's that been like for you and the other people who put in all this time kind of backstage to make sure that this wouldn't go unremarked upon, to now finally have that attention that should have been paid to this story long ago arrive? And two, what's the update on how exactly they're continuing to deflect responsibility for this? Because my understanding is that while Snyder sort of went out of his way to say the words "I'm sorry" in his State of the State address, the administration is still spinning this real hard, right? So
yeah.
given that you guys finally were able to get all of this into the public eye to the extent that it's now an unquestionably major national story, what's that like?
I'll answer your both those questions, but let me just take one more step back to say what the game changer was, which was, after we held our press conference, it actually is when the Virginia Tech results started to become known. There was a doctor at Hurley Children's Hospital, a pediatrician at Hurley Children's Hospital, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who started seeing these results and decided to do her own study, because Hurley is kind of a regional hospital. They had a lot of data regarding the blood levels in children 5 and under. So she looked at a 9-month period before the switch and a 9-month period after the switch, and found that the percentage of children with elevated levels of lead in their blood doubled after the switch, and that in areas where our tests were finding the highest lead levels in the water, she found the highest lead levels in the blood of kids.
Got it.
And so she nailed it. She nailed it in terms of the correlation between the lead in the water, but also the correlation between before when they were on the Detroit system to after when they were on the river water.
And so at that point, it basically becomes impossible for the state and for Snyder's team to continue denying that there's a problem here.
Except that they also attacked Hannah Atisha, who is also...
At least they're consistent.
Yes. I'm working on a short documentary now. It's called Deny and Attack.
Okay.
Because that was their whole MO, right?
You deny
there's a problem and you attack the people that are trying to tell the truth. And Hannah Atisha is a truth teller, and she's fearless and also incredibly ethical. That's sort of part of the irony here. You got people like Brad Werfel attacking people like Mona Hannah Atisha and Mark Edwards. He's not fit to shine their shoes and out there attacking them. So they go after Hannah Atisha, saying the governor's spokeswoman, who is Brad's wife, Sarah Werfel, saying that Hannah Atisha spliced and diced her data. You know, again, this is slanderous to accuse a researcher of manipulating their data to come to a certain outcome is a slanderous attack. What happened, though, was that the Detroit Free Press, which is the major daily here, one of the major dailies, got the state data and analyzed it themselves and said, you know what, there, Michigan, your data actually confirms what Hannah Atisha is reporting. And that was then the game over point. Although they still, even after that, tried to deny the connection to the river.
Right.
You know, they said, oh, it's these old lead service lines, which is the lead service lines is where the lead is leaching from. But it's because they're using this highly corrosive water and not applying the corrosion control. And so that until finally, in October, they say, okay, it is the river. And Snyder at that point finally lets the people of Flint go back to the Detroit system. But the problem is that the piping infrastructure has been so chewed up that it's taken a lot of time in order to get the water back to the point where it is safe. So that's, you know, that's sort of the whole story of how we got to where we are.
Yeah, that sequence that you're describing here over a year and a half or more of Snyder's team kind of defending one trench publicly for as long as they could until somebody proves, actually, no, that's not true. And then just sort of falling back to the next trench and standing strong in that one for as long as they can until they get outflanked and then falling back. They're doing it again now, right? I mean, they're continuing to they can no longer say the water's safe. They can no longer say, well, the results that show the water's unsafe are skewed. They can no longer say, well, it's really just about the pipes. They're stuck. Acknowledging that it's the river water and that the source sin here from a public policy perspective was the decision to draw water from that river without treating it properly. And so now it seems like, as best I can tell from this far away, it seems like they've retreated to a new sort of defense point here, which is the argument that we weren't the ones who decided to go back to the river. It was the city of Flint itself, and they're trying to say that the city council voted to do that. My understanding is that's not just a he said she said. This is a provably false narrative still from the Snyder administration, because we've got, am I right, that there are documents that illustrate that city officials in Flint who were already being overridden by an emergency manager had told the state, no, we don't want to use river water. And that emergency managers proceeded to put that plan into effect over and above those expressed local wishes, right?
Exactly. And we know that because of another document that I obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which is in March of 2014. So the decision and the city council, what they're doing is they're taking a kernel of truth, which is that the city council and mayor approved of the city leaving the Detroit system and joining the getting their water from this new pipeline that's being built from Lake Huron. But it's not, it's still under construction. And so the lie is, and I got one of the emergency managers on tape actually uttering it, was that Detroit, after that decision to go with the pipeline was made, Detroit canceled a long-term contract. But, which is true, and that Governor Snyder pointed that out in his State of the State speech. But what he didn't point out was that Detroit wanted to keep selling Flint water for as long as Detroit could keep selling them water, because Flint is their biggest suburban customer. So losing them as a customer was a huge, huge financial hit. And that's the lie by omission in the State of the State speech, or, you know, a direct lie that Detroit kicked Flint off its system. That's the lie, and that's a provable lie based on this document from Darnell Early, the emergency manager over Flint in 2014, and now the emergency manager over Detroit Public Schools. So you have the guy that was directly involved in the lead poisoning of Flint children in charge of the well-being of the 46,000 kids that remain in Detroit Public School System. That, you know, so that's another one of the sort of sick ironies of all this. But Early, his name is on a letter to Detroit saying, received your offer, thanks, but no thanks. We decided to go with the river. So, you know, they can try to weasel their way around this all they want, but eventually that, you know, truth is going to stick, and it's going to stick good once and for all. And we have another short video called Circle of Lies, where we have the emergency manager saying Detroit kicked them off. We have the governor's spokeswoman, Sarah Werfel, Brad's wife, saying that Detroit kicked them off. And then we have Howard Kroft, the former director of Public Works, on tape, and he starts to say that lie. And I stop him. I say, Howard, stop right there, man. I got the letter from Early. You know, don't give me that BS. What's the truth? And he kind of crumbled right there on camera. It's sort of amazing to watch. But he says, okay, Detroit cancels the contract, and we do a financial analysis to see what's best for the city of Flint. And that analysis goes up into the state is involved, and that the decision's made to use the river. And I go, that decision, does that go all the way to the governor's office? And Howard looks and he says, all the way to the governor's office. So that's why Snyder, you know, is given his lies of omission in the State of the State speech, because if Howard Kroft is to be believed, then his office was directly involved in making that decision. And when you ask people a direct question, why would his, she's now a former spokeswoman. There's a lot of former people involved in this story at this point because they keep resigning. But, you know, if you ask someone, was your boss involved in this decision? And she says, oh, he couldn't have been involved because, you know, Flint, we were kicked off, Flint was kicked off the Detroit system, so how could we have made that decision?
Well, and Kurt Guyette, I'm going to stop you there.
Okay.
But in the last minute that we have, since you're, yeah. I mean, you're bringing up, you know, Snyder's role in this and lies by omission in his State of the State speech, there have been calls for him to resign.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe that's a fair and warranted outcome here. Maybe it would amount to partial justice for the great havoc that has been wreaked in the lives of poor and largely black families in Flint. Do you think that Governor Snyder should resign? And do you think that that would do anything to advance a sense of justice by those impacted in the city?
Well, you know, I'm a reporter, and it's not really my role to say whether the governor should resign or not. But I'll tell you, from a personal perspective, you know, The head of the Department of Environmental Quality has resigned. Brad Werfel, the spokesman, has resigned. Howard Kroft has resigned. The head of the EPA Region 5 has resigned. But you know what? Kids were poisoned here. Kids are going to be damaged for their whole lives as a result of this. And, you know, when people say heads roll, you know, a resignation, that's not, to me, that's not any head rolling. And if there are crimes committed here, people need to be prosecuted. And you know, resignations aren't enough as far as I'm concerned.
Kurt Guyette is an investigative reporter with the ACLU of Michigan. He was instrumental in breaking the story of the Flint water crisis over a year ago. Kurt, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.